This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Welcome to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Holland & Knight, LLP, based in Northern Virginia. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hey Joe, today we're going to talk about a range of issues that impact government contractors, whether it's teaming arrangements, small business programs, maybe a little bit protest, maybe even yesterday, hot off the presses, came the latest Mythbusters campaign, and I would like to get your take on that a little bit. But we're going to start first, I think, with a little bit about mergers and acquisitions and, you know, that mm-hmm. market and what's going on there. And I know yesterday that GTSI it was announced it was going to be acquired by Unicom, and GTSI is a known government contractor. Mm-hmm. Does that, you know, sort of that acquisition indicate or reflect anything in the marketplace to you, or what's going on?
I think it's mostly a continuation of what we've seen over the last decade or so. You know, when you're a government contractor, there are two ways really to grow your business. One is to go out and bid on and win new contracts. The other one is to go out and acquire companies that have already won contracts. I suppose you could do a little of both, acquire right. a company and then use
the
their
best
resources,
of both worlds, right?
Right, resources to expand. You know, we see the budgets shrinking. Everyone's afraid of sequestration or possible sequestration in next year. And so, you know, mergers and acquisitions of government contractors, it's still a good way to grow your business, meet your revenue growth targets. And we see a lot of that. We do a lot of that work in my firm. So,
do you do that? You do that yourself, right?
Well, we have a group of lawyers that specialize in helping companies either prepare for. What you might call a liquidation event, whether it's a sale or a merger. We also, and then we represent them in the sale. I'm considered, I guess, in our government contracts practice. So I help the deal lawyers
right.
Understand some of the unique government contract issues that you see in a merger or acquisition.
So just to pick up on that topic real quick, that's sort of the due mm-hmm. diligence aspect of it. So are you helping companies figure out, hey, this is what, you know, this contract language means when they're looking at, you know, what the liabilities and what's going on with a particular contract? Is
yeah,
that kind
well,
of stuff?
Well, yeah, sure. When you do deal work, you have to sort of distinguish between buy and sell side. When you represent a seller, you have certain tasks, certain issues you have to deal with. When you represent a buyer, you have a different set of issues. Due diligence is something we do a lot of when we're representing the buyer.
Right. Okay.
And what we really try to do is get a handle on the selling company's backlog of government contracts, their portfolio of contracts, and really get an understanding of how valuable it is. Is it as valuable a backlog as, say, the investment bankers have been saying it is?
okay.
And we try to understand whether the contracts will survive the deal. You might call it transfer risk.
Okay. It's like you're talking situations where it's going to be a novation or is it just, hey, how long is this, you know, what's the term of the contract?
Right.
Is it really going to be there? Are they going to be recompeting? Is that kind of thing?
Yes. And it goes even broader than that, really. When we talk about novations, there are basically two types of acquisitions, two basic types. One is you purchase the assets of a business. The other one is you just purchase the stock of the business. And if you purchase the stock of a company, it's really just transferring ownership from one group of shareholders to another group. And in a stock transfer, the government contracting regulations don't require a novation agreement. But there are still certain types of contracts that don't transfer as easily. For example, we might talk about this later today, but 8A contracts, you know, if
sure.
the seller was at one point in the 8A program and won some 8A set-aside contracts, or worse, sole source contracts. Small businesses, you know, contracts that are set aside for small businesses have some transfer risk associated with them. It doesn't mean they can't transfer. It just means you have to do a little more legwork to understand the customer, to understand the rules. Sometimes you need to work with the Small Business Administration, especially with 8A contracts. That's the kind of thing we look at. We also look for...
Well, just to pick up on that, so
sure.
In the small business set-aside world, that's a good point. And mm-hmm. I was thinking national security. We can talk about that maybe in a minute. But you know, in the small business set-aside world, right, I think mm-hmm. the rules are, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you are the expert here, if you're being acquired by a company, you do have to essentially recertify at the time of the acquisition, right, back to, or is that during the contract term, or is it at the end of the contract? How does that work?
That's a great question, because it was big news in the M&A government contract space about 5 years ago. Traditionally, the rule was when a contract is set aside for small businesses, the bidders certify as small on the date they submit their proposal. And if you win the contract, you know, the government is allowed to consider you a small business for the duration of the contract. Now, until mid-2007, it didn't matter whether or not the contractor was acquired. But the Washington Post and certain other news organizations sort of looked into this, and they realized that the government was getting what they call small business credit for contracts that had been awarded to firms that had subsequently been acquired by, you know, very large companies.
Sure, sure.
And so the government was meeting its small business goals with contract dollars that were being paid to, you know, very large companies. And so this was an issue with the SBA and the procurement community, and they settled on a bit of a compromise. You know, when an 8A contract is – when the contractor of an who is an 8A sells its business – absent some permission from SBA, you need to get a waiver or the contract has to be terminated. The SBA decided to not to go that route with small business set-aside contracts. All they really require is that the contractor recertify its status within 30 days after an acquisition, whether or not it's a stock or an asset acquisition. And then the contract can't be counted towards the government's small business goals going forward. I think, candidly, I think a lot of folks in the small business and in the M&A community were worried that that rule was really going to have a chilling effect on the M&A market, but anecdotally, we haven't seen it.
Right, yeah, because I think it would, you know, that, and that's interesting you haven't seen it, because, you know, part of the idea is you're trying to create, you know, the goal is to grow small businesses, right?
And right.
To be successful. What happens in the commercial marketplace, you know, successful companies go acquire other successful companies,
right?
To grow to further. And if you're going to limit that ability, you know, in a certain sense for the small business owner to get rich, to make some money out of their own success, you know.
Well, you know, they say the American dream is to own your own business. The American dream is actually to sell your own business.
That's right.
You know, and walk away a wealthy person. Yeah, but frankly, we haven't seen. You know, we've still seen small business or companies with a sizable portfolio of small business contracts. You know, still draw interest from both strategic and private equity buyers.
Right, and just in terms of the, and I guess it depends on the deal, right? But you know, the people, why do people acquire their people? You mentioned at the top. The idea that the market is shrinking a bit, and if you're going to grow, that's one way to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Is it about capabilities or certain unique aspects of, you know, in particular small businesses that larger companies are looking for that drives the market?
I think each deal has its own dynamics. In some deals, you know, you might see a private equity firm, you know, a company that doesn't actually operate any businesses, but just investors, want to buy a company because it's been producing revenue off its contracts, and they're buying a nice revenue stream. Other private equity firms might think about rolling up a bunch of small businesses into one large government contractor. You know, an example of a private equity firm in this space is probably the Carlyle Group.
Right.
Traditionally.
Sure.
A strategic buyer would be a company that's an operating government contractor and wants to buy another operating company. And they might do it because they want to get access to a certain contract vehicle, some vehicle that has the potential to, you know, grow in the future. Others might want to, you know, for one hot issue these days is access to security clearances. If you have a workforce with a lot of folks who have top secret security clearances, that's a good thing to have in your, you know, it's a good resource to have. So companies sometimes want to get access to the cleared personnel. You might also look at a company that just has a relationship with an agency that you want to get into.
Sure.
And, you know, going back to classified work, I mean, companies that hold contracts with some of the intelligence agencies are attractive these days.
And hey, Joe, right now we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Hall & Knight LLP. And we'll talk a little bit more about mergers and teaming arrangements as well. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Hall & Knight LLP. And we've been talking about mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, Joe, we're going to finish up with that a little bit and talk about another way companies sort of work together to compete, and that's teaming arrangements. But, you know, first, you know, when we broke, you were talking about, you know, sort of the reasons why folks decide to go buy somebody or sell, you know, getting additional capability or trying to grow business in a shrinking market. And that's where I want to sort of get your final thoughts on that, and then we'll move on to teaming arrangements. And that is, you know, where do you see the market going moving forward? You know, we have significant, you know, budget pressure moving forward, obviously, given the deficit, and, you know, government contracting is starting to trend down a bit. And what does that mean, and what do you see, you know, in terms of mergers and acquisitions?
Sure. Well, of course, everybody's trying to read the tea leaves out there. I mean,
Well, that's why I got you on the show, Joe. Yeah. I want you to read them for us.
There's certain people that are better fortune tellers than I am at this. You know, I'm a lawyer that works on a lot of these deals, and so what I see it more anecdotally than you know, through surveys or things of that nature. But you know, I've been doing this now for more than 20 years, and I remember during the 90s we saw a lot of consolidation, a lot of M&A activity among the large companies. And anecdotally, my clients always seem to be on the sell side of that one, so I had to go look for new clients.
Right. That's unfortunate, right?
Yeah, McDonnell Douglas was our client of ours. They got acquired by Boeing. And,
right. You know, so. Hey, and that probably is that coming out, do you think, you know, that I mean, just to think about that, is that like a post-Cold War kind of, you know, the defense budget, you know,
in the 90s?
Yeah, does that drove
absolutely.
That?
That was because of the you know, the Cold War ended, and you know, we had at some point in the Cold War we probably had dozens of airframe manufacturers.
Sure. Yeah.
And we just don't have that many different models. And one of the things you also saw in the start in the 90s and continues today is large weapon systems often are joint. In other words, you build an airplane. Fighter plane, and it's joint for the Army, Navy, and Marines.
Right.
Excuse me, the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, or possibly the Army too. So with yeah, there are just fewer procurements, fewer bet the company procurements, and the winners went on, and the losers often were acquired.
Right.
You know, we saw the consolidation at the top tier, but I don't think they can consolidate much more than they have. I mean, they're really only, depending on how you count, five or six large defense contractors, I mean, really large defense contractors, and you need some competition out there. So I don't know how much more the consolidation there can be at the top, but there still is, I think, a desire to grow by acquiring smaller and mid-sized companies. And I have no reason to think it's going to stop. I really don't. I hope it doesn't.
Right. Well, spoken as a true lawyer, right there, Joe.
But you know, as you say, you know, it's basically is your a small business owner's desire to grow the company and then sell.
Right. And, hey, that's what it's about.
That's right. And, but once that happens, of course, then smaller companies get a chance to start up and do the same thing. So it's sort of a natural evolution and a natural cycle.
It's the market, right? So in turning into teaming arrangements and just talking about those a bit, because you did, you know, you, Joe, it's like you've done this before, right? You talked about joint, you know, ventures in the context of weapon systems, and now we're going to turn to teaming arrangements. And can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what different types of teaming arrangements that, you know, government contractors enter into?
Sure. They're really only, I mean, I think you can take all teaming arrangements and divide them into three categories. The first and probably the most common is where you have one company acting as the prime contractor, and then it teams with other companies. But if company A wins the prime contract, the teaming partners would become subcontractors.
Sure.
So you definitely in that instance have a dominant party at the prime, and then you have subcontractors, prime sub. Another form of teaming arrangement that's become increasingly popular in my experience is joint ventures. And that's where two or more parties get together and really form another entity. It could be a partnership or it could be a legal entity like a limited liability company.
Sure.
And the joint venture itself is the bidder, is the prime contractor, has the direct relationship with the government. Now, the joint venture could have subcontractors too, but basically, the two parties that have decided to get together and bid on something are both owners of an entity that will itself be the prime contractor.
And why? In using that particular approach, is that about, you know, sharing the? I mean, allocating risk in a certain way, and when you create that new legal entity, is it about how you know what you know? You could, you know, why do folks choose that over the traditional prime sub relationship?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One thing you have to remember, of course, is that you can't always do that. In other words, you can't always bid as a joint venture. If a procurement's set aside for small businesses, there are defined circumstances in which the companies can form a joint venture, and we can talk about those. But the advantage is, well, there are several. I mean, if you're a large company, you know, a large defense contractor, and you're teaming with a smaller business, you'd rather be in a joint venture, all things being equal, I think, because you have more control. You're basically a prime contractor or a co-prime, as opposed to, taking orders from a smaller prime contractor. I mean, look at it this way. If you're in a joint venture, you view your customer as the government agency. If you're a subcontractor, your customer is the prime contractor. You know, I think there's some tactical reasons why two companies can benefit from being a joint venture as opposed to prime sub. Anybody who's familiar with government cost accounting and billing and understands that at least in certain types of contracts, if a subcontractor sends you an invoice as the prime, you have to mark that invoice up and pass it on to the government. So you have sort of a markup on top of a markup, or another way to look at it would be you have two levels of profit, two levels of G&A, two levels of overhead. I think you can eliminate that to some degree if you get together as a joint venture.
So you only have one as opposed to
so it's cheaper.
Yeah, it reduces the costs.
Right, and you know, these days, I mean, everybody of course wants to make money on their contracts, but ultimately it's a competitive marketplace, and you want to keep your bid lean and your costs down.
Especially, I think in the environment now, and there is. Increasing, focus on cost in the evaluation.
Absolutely. No matter what the RFP says about how important cost is, it's always very important.
Right.
Because a lot of times the RFPs will come out and they'll say cost is the least important factor, but it's always an important factor in my experience. You know, another example or another reason why a joint venture I think is advantageous, it has to do with how the government considers the qualifications of the teaming parties. Sometimes they won't consider the experience or the past performance of a subcontractor at all, or at least not to the same degree they will if you're in a joint venture relationship. So if a large and a small business get together, you can really bolster your qualifications, I think, as opposed to prime sub.
Right. That's, and that goes to, you know, when you're deciding how you're going to compete, you got to look at how the government's crafting that RFP, right?
Yes.
And what the evaluation criteria, because to your point, you know, if the government is, you know, sees that, you could see how the government could say logically, hey, look, if you're a subcontractor, you may have certain capabilities of past performance, but you're not, I don't have privity of contract with you.
Right.
I don't have that direct relationship. Somebody else does who doesn't have quite as much experience.
Right.
Now that could play in versus if you bring in both those capabilities as part of a joint venture prime, you know, the government could may feel more comfortable with that.
Right. So, you know, Roger, you make a great point. Clients always come to me and say, well, if we form a joint venture, can the government consider both parties' experience? And I said, well, what does the RFP say? And they said, well, it's not out yet. I, you know, frankly, I don't think you should make a final decision on how you're going to approach the procurement, how you're going to structure your relationship until you see that RFP.
Right. Absolutely.
So, because it really is all, it can be RFP specific. There aren't necessarily a one-size-fits-all set of rules for how experience and past performance gets evaluated.
And Joe, I have a rule right now. That rule is I'm on a hard break, so we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Holland & Knight, LLP. And we'll talk some more about teaming arrangements and a little bit about small businesses. You're listening to, and small business rules, you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Holland & Knight LLP. And when we were, took our break, we were talking about teaming arrangements. I want to continue that discussion, Joe. And you know, when we did make that break, we were just you were sort of making that, reiterating this point or that common sense point. It, you know, you got to look at the RFP before you decide whether a joint venture or even, you know, that's how you're going to compete and the team you're going to create if you're potentially a prime and the structure that you use. That is a, pretty much dependent upon how the RFP is written.
Absolutely. I mean, the RFP will sometimes encourage certain types of teaming relationships, either expressly or implicitly. By the way, they say they're going to evaluate a major subcontractor's quals, if you will. I've even seen, RFPs that encourage joint ventures. You know, one thing, there is a third type of
well, I was going to get to that, but go ahead. You beat me to it.
Well, you know, obviously this is, I'm sure, near and dear to your heart and the coalitions. But, you know, the GSA came up with a third type of teaming arrangement a few years ago. I wish they'd given it a different name because it sometimes I think it can lead to confusion, but they call it a contractor team arrangement or a CTA. Of course, you know, the industry generally refers to teaming arrangements to, as any type of marriage between two or more companies, whether it's a prime sub or a joint venture. But the GSA, if you're dealing with a competitive procurement among GSA schedule contractors, and I'm going to assume that the listeners all know about a GSA schedule contract.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Joe, I got a very sophisticated audience out there. And I love them to death.
And I consider myself one of them. What the GSA allows is a teaming arrangement where basically two or more companies act as dual prime contractors. They're not in a prime sub relationship because both have direct, what we call privity of contract with the government through their own GSA schedule contracts. They're both of their contracts are binding on the subsequent award. They have to pay their fees to GSA individually.
Sure. Yes.
But it's not a joint venture in the sense that a new entity isn't formed by the contractors who have teamed together. I think it's a great way to approach a teaming relationship if you're in a GSA schedule environment. And I guess I have seen, back to our previous discussion, when you see RFQs come out from GSA or agencies, they often really do encourage contractors to form these contractor team arrangements.
Yeah, and in those situations, what are you seeing? When or is it something where, you know, an agency wants a cross-cutting solution? So, you know, there's a services piece and a product piece. What have you seen with regard to those kind of RFQs?
I have seen that. That's definitely true. Sometimes they want to get access to more than one schedule. You might have companies that sell hardware supplies, but other companies that sell, HVAC supplies. And so they might want access to more than one schedule, because the GSA has different schedules for different types of products. I've also seen that sometimes they may like a mixture of small and large businesses, 8A and large businesses. And so they encourage companies to team together in a relationship where you might have, one 8A, one small, and one large. It's technically not a set aside in that sense, but what they're saying in the RFP in these situations is you're going to get extra credit in the evaluation if you have small business participation in the team arrangement, in the contractor team arrangement level. So that's one area I've seen it.
So if an agency was doing a set aside off the GSA schedules, which they can do now in discretionary set asides. Mm-hmm. Are they limiting those teams to only small businesses in order to be able to take credit? Or I think that's what they're doing at this point.
What I have seen in that area, and we don't necessarily have, one thing is about contractor team arrangements, these sort of GSA unique creations. You have to understand that there aren't really clear regulations on these. A lot of what's going on is people are sort of interpreting guidance that's on the GSA website. There's some case law out there. And so the rules aren't necessarily clearly defined in some respects. But I think what I've seen in a few instances is in a small business set-aside, you know, there has to be a small business on the team in a dual prime relationship. You can have large businesses on the team, but they want to see the small business designated what they call the team lead, which means, again, you have two companies, both with a direct privity relationship with the government, but one of them's really in charge. One of them's the sort of main point of contact for the contract. That's what I have seen.
Yeah, is that... interesting. We'll see how now that they have that formal sort of ability to set aside items, how they're going to interpret that rule. Because you could, in a traditional small business set aside, right? A small business has it has to be a product of small business, right? Or if it's a service, 51%, right, of the work has to be done by the small business, then it's okay.
Right.
So you would think if that small business was the lead of the team and they were doing 51%, I mean, that would be okay.
Right.
But, because the guidance isn't quite clear, right, I don't think, to how GSA is implementing it. I mean, I think that's an area that's going to be shake out over time over the next.
Yeah. I don't have any inside knowledge to this effect, but I would like to think that GSA and SBA might be working this out together.
Yeah.
And so that they could come out with some clear rules, because it's unfortunate to put a lot of resources into bidding on a procurement, whether it's GSA schedule or something else, and win it and then find out that your teaming relationship may have violated some rule, despite your best efforts to structure it within the bounds of the law, because sometimes the rules are just ambiguous.
Right.
And no one's thought of certain situations, or the regulations are ambiguous.
Keeping up that thought, in the small business environment, can you talk a little bit about mentor-protege agreements and those relationships? And
sure.
What are they? And
well, again, you have to... When you talk about mentor-protege programs, that's really what it is. It's a mentor-protege program. The SBA has a mentor-protege program, and then all the other agencies have their own mentor-protege program. But frankly, it's the SBA's program that really gives large businesses more so than the others, a chance to participate in a procurement that's otherwise set aside for 8As or small businesses. And so let's just stay on the SBA program because I know your show only lasts an hour.
Right. We could talk about everybody's. We'd be here for 3 weeks.
But the SBA program is really the one I think most people are interested in. And so as of right now, it's the protege must be an 8A firm, current participant in the 8A program. Now, Congress has said to SBA, you need to issue some new regulations to allow other classifications to participate as the protege firm. For example, a service-disabled, veteran-owned business, a hub-zone business. But currently, the SBA only permits 8A firms to serve as the protege, and a firm of any size can be the mentor company. And so what you do is the mentor and the protege get together, and they sign an agreement called a mentor-protege agreement. It's countersigned by SBA, assuming SBA approves it. And the mentor company agrees to give developmental assistance to the protege firm in a variety of forms. Could be subcontracts, could be just support with various activities. The real benefit, I think, to the SBA's mentor-protege program is once a mentor-protege relationship is formed, the mentor and the protege can form a joint venture, and that joint venture, provided it meets certain regulatory requirements, can qualify as a small business or, in some instances, an 8A business for purposes of bidding on a contract that's set aside for 8As or smalls.
Right now, we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Joe Horniak, partner at Holland & Knight, LLP, and we'll finish up our discussion on mentor-protege agreements, talk a little small business, perhaps a little Mythbusters memo that just came out yesterday, May 7th, the second edition of the OFPP Mythbusters memo. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Joe Horniak. Joe is a partner at Holland & Knight, LLP. And when we took the break, we were talking about mentor-protege agreements. And Joe, you were talking about how large businesses can play a role in competing, when they're sort of teaming, I guess, or joint venture with a protege.
Sure, I think the SBA expects the mentor firm, the large business, typically doesn't have to be a large business, by the way, but the mentor firm to provide assistance of all kinds to the or a variety of kinds, I should say, to the 8A protege. But the real main benefit I see companies getting out of the program is, I'll give you a specific example. I'll try to do it quickly. In absent some sort of mentor-protege relationship, if a contract were set aside for 8A firms, then a large firm like Lockheed Martin, the only way it could participate in the procurement would be as a subcontractor. And Roger, as you noted earlier, there's this limitation on how much of the work you can subcontract. It's 50% is really right. The maximum in a procurement that's set aside. So, in that example, the Lockheed's role would be limited to a subcontractor. If Lockheed enters into a mentor-protege relationship, it could form a joint venture with the 8A protege firm, and that joint venture could bid as prime contractor. So essentially, Lockheed could be in a prime contract role, in conjunction with another firm, but it could be in a privity relationship with the government on a contract that is otherwise set aside for an 8A business, for 8A or small businesses. I could go into depth as to why that is, but suffice to say, it really gives the mentor and the protege more options in terms of teaming together, forming joint ventures, winning contracts that would otherwise be set aside for small and 8A businesses.
So is that the policy dynamic to that? Is that why large businesses are able to sort of have that privity of relationship? I guess I do want you to go into a little bit why that's okay to do from a policy perspective of why the rules were written that way.
Well, if if Lockheed Martin, for example, formed a joint venture with a company that it didn't have a protege relationship with, the two companies would be deemed to be affiliated, and so they essentially the smaller firm, the 8A firm in our example, would not qualify because it would be deemed to be affiliated with Lockheed Martin. But what SBA has said is we'll give you an exemption from that affiliation rule if we approve you to be a mentor to this company, because we think they're going to benefit. To get to your question about policy, they think the 8A protege firm is going to benefit from having Lockheed's
support, expertise.
Yeah, support under SBA's supervision. Okay, because SBA is a party to that mentor protege agreement. It's monitoring the agreement on an annual basis. It gets to see whether Lockheed's living up to its commitment to support this 8A business, as opposed to just, you know, getting in on the act of small business contracts. So from a policy standpoint, they say, okay, Lockheed Martins of the world, we will allow you to joint venture with these 8A firms and win prime contracts that are set aside, but the trade-off is you've got to provide developmental support. And I think SBA believes that is, you know, that's worth the trade-off.
Right. For the benefits 8As, there, yeah. Right.
And I'll say personally, I think, you know, it's a good program. Like every other government program, it can get abused. A lot of 8A businesses have benefited tremendously from the program.
And that's sort of why they're right. You mentioned they're trying to open it up to other categories,
yes,
more so.
Absolutely.
Right?
And
it has worked well.
It's worked well for 8As, and there's no reason why, if you're trying to encourage participation of service-disabled veteran-owned firms and hub-zone firms, why they shouldn't have the same opportunities.
Sure. Turning to small businesses just real quickly, and we're about halfway through our last segment, but so I just wanted to touch on that a little bit. What do you think the biggest changes recently with regard to small business rules? Is it this mentor protege move, or just in terms of what we have a real impact on helping small businesses?
Well, looking at it very broadly, I think what I'm seeing a lot of an increased focus on lately is investigations and enforcement of companies, essentially trying to take advantage of these small business programs when they shouldn't be. Companies that are, certifying that they meet the regulatory requirements for, say, service-disabled veteran-owned status when, in fact, they don't. Front companies, if you will. And I think the SBA, the Department of Justice, the whistleblowers out there are really looking for companies who are basically defrauding the government by taking advantage of these programs when they shouldn't be. Because, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of these programs rely on the contractor's self-certification that they meet the rules. And so there's a good faith aspect to it. And I think that's what I'm seeing more focus on lately than anything else in the small business area. And, you really need to turn square corners, as they say, when you deal with the government. And I think you need to turn even sharper corners when you deal with these small business programs.
Right. Well, that's what why they hire lawyers like you, right?
You betcha.
I
will say this, just in terms of hiring lawyers, we can do a lot more for you as a contractor on the front end. In other words, we want to bid on this procurement, help us structure our team, help us determine whether we're eligible for this specific type of contract. We can, it's an ounce of prevention. You know, when you come to us because you've gotten a subpoena, a grand jury subpoena or an administrative subpoena from some inspector general, whether it's SBAs or GSAs, our ability to help you and keep you out of trouble is somewhat limited at that point.
Yeah, Joe, you speak in a universal truth from my perspective, my
yes.
experience. It works the same way in government. You know, I remember when I was in government in a general counsel's office, the clients, the internal government clients who, proactively involved their attorneys in the, acquisition planning process up front, invariably, the outcome was generally better. May sound self-serving or, what do you mean? But, you know, dealing with the regulations and complexity of them and going through that procurement process, both in private sector and in, on the public side, you know, it's always good to have, you know, that attorney as part of your planning process from my perspective.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
So,
and if I can get access to the agency's attorneys, I feel like I can work out problems a lot better than if they stay behind the scenes.
Right. And that goes to, a couple things I wanted to ask you about that just came out yesterday. May 7th, OFPP came out with Myth-Busting 2, Addressing Misconceptions and Further Improving Communication During the Acquisition Process. And this sort of Mythbusters memo focuses on, you know, what are industry misconceptions with regard to government's operations or government procedures. And you touched on a couple of these, I think, in our discussions. But one of them in particular, there's... you know, there's one misconception. It's number 7 out of 8 that talks about evaluation criteria. And basically the fact or the lesson there is that, that the misconceptions you don't really need to worry about, the evaluation criteria. And that's, fundamentally the good thing that this does is points out that, yes, you have to tailor. It's reminding industry that you do have to tailor your acquisition your proposal to the evaluation criteria. And we talked about that in the context of whether you're going to do a joint venture, prime sub relationship, how you structure the team, not only what the proposal actually looks like.
Yes. I'm not so sure I would call this a misconception. I mean, what it says is, to develop my proposal, I don't really need to tailor my solution to the specific solicitation, since the government won't read my proposal that closely anyway. I'm reading, of course, from the stated misconceptions. I don't know that I would say that's a misconception. I do think that a lot of contractors believe that the government picks who they want, regardless of whose proposal actually is written or would qualify for the award under the evaluation criteria in the solicitation. I don't think that's really true most of the time. I've seen the inside of a lot of evaluations, because I do a lot of bid protest work, and when you get involved in bid protests, you see the government evaluation documents. And I don't want to sound naive or Pollyannish, but I do believe in most cases the government evaluators take the RFP, look at the evaluation criteria, read the proposals, decide whose proposal really is the best value or the one that deserves to win based on those criteria. I think I would only add to this is it's not only the evaluation criteria that you should read, but the proposal preparation instructions.
Right.
You don't want to lose a procurement because you were 51 pages when there was a 51 page limit.
Yeah. Another one I want to just ask you real quickly about is there's a misconception in here about debriefings, and the misconception says if I lose a competition, I shouldn't bother to ask for a debriefing. The contracting officer won't share any helpful information with me. And the fact or, the rebuttal to that in this is that unsuccessful offeror should ask for a debriefing to understand the award decision and improve future proposals. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yes. First of all, I do think this is a great memo in the whole. I do. And I think I totally agree with this statement here that you should ask for a debriefing. I find most offerers... unsuccessful offerors do. One of the points they make in this memo, the OFPP, is that not only unsuccessful offerors, but the successful offeror, the one who's picked for award, has the right to ask for a debriefing and should do so. The memo says that an unsuccessful offer should ask for a debriefing to understand the award decision and to improve future proposals. Beating around the bush here. I mean, really, one of the main reasons why offerors request a debriefing is to find out whether somehow they were mistreated and have grounds to file a bid protest. And that's when I think the misconception about contracting officers maybe being reluctant to share information is if the CO or the evaluators who are there on behalf of the government at the debriefing, if they think the offeror who's being debriefed is looking for ammunition to file a protest, they might be a tad more guarded in some of their comments. But I absolutely think you should ask for one. I think if you're spending a lot of money on a proposal effort, you should find out why you weren't successful. and find out whether, you know, there was some sort of foul in the process, whether the government didn't follow the proper procedures and whether you have an opportunity for a protest.
And from the government perspective, it, you know, to your point, it gives them an opportunity to explain why everything they did was reasonable and consistent with, you know, the regulation evaluation criteria.
The more candid the government is, the hope is the contractor will realize, you know, they were straight with me. I wasn't mistreated. What I hear a lot of clients say when they come out of debriefings is they didn't admit to anything, you know, but the body language looked awkward. When we asked this question of the government evaluators, their body language looked awkward. So we think they're hiding something. You know, I hear that a lot, and I don't know what to make of it because it doesn't give me any ammunition for protest. You know, I think a candid exchange is really in everybody's interests. And, you know, I don't know if I have time to there's one strong reason why an awardee should ask for a debriefing.
Sure, absolutely. Okay?
And the reason is, having been through bid protests many, many times, just taking an example, if there's a procurement with four offerers, one gets picked, the three losing entities ask for a debriefing and they receive it. If one or more of those unsuccessful offerers, the losers, ask for file a protest, sometimes the protest gets sustained by, you know, the GAO or the court, and sometimes the agency just decides to go back and do a reevaluation or, you know, fix what was alleged to have been wrong. It happens very often, probably close to 50% of the time. Sometimes it involves a new round of proposals. And if you stop and think for a second, if you were the original awardee and you didn't get a debriefing, but everybody else got a debriefing, now they've got an advantage over
you. They have a competitive advantage.
Absolutely. Right. Not only do they know your price, because your price was the winner's price is disclosed at a debriefing, but they also know how the agency evaluated them, you know, their strengths and weaknesses in their proposal. So really, an awardee should definitely ask for a debriefing. Right. And that's what's stated here in some, I should say it's implied in the OFPP memo.
Right. Well, and yeah. Joe, that's a great point. And, you know, I want to, and we've come to the end of the show, so I want to thank Joe Horniak, partner at Holland & Knight LLP, for joining me today. This is, I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.